This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of the authors of a new book, which is titled The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon. It's a book that explores the career and also the free speech struggles of Lenny Bruce. It also includes a companion CD with some of his routines and also interviews with people who were followers and friends. Our guest is Ronald Collins. He was a graduate of Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He was a judicial fellow in the U.S. Supreme Court. He is currently the First Amendment Scholar in Residence at the First Amendment Center in Arlington, Virginia. And he's written scholarly articles in the Harvard, Stanford, and Michigan Law Reviews, and also more than 150 newspaper op-ed pieces. His co-author, by the way, on the book is David Scover. He's a law professor at Seattle University Law School. The book is out now. It's in the bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Comments are welcome. We just ask callers to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. Anyone is welcome to call. Mr. Collins, hello.
Greetings. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. We certainly appreciate it. I understand that you and Mr. Scover, your co-author, were very much involved in this effort to persuade Governor Pataki to pardon Lenny Bruce. Why is it that you thought this was such an important thing now, so many years after the trial, and in fact, so many years after his death?
Well, I mean, of course, Lenny Bruce dies in 1966, so it's been a long time. He was convicted in New York in 1964 of obscenity, and that conviction, for reasons we can get into, was never overturned. When David and I wrote The Trials of Lenny Bruce, published, by the way, by an Illinois publisher, Sourcebook, so I could mention that, when we wrote that, it took us 5 years to write, we were just amazed that these things happened in our own lifetimes. Admittedly, we were very young. And that, you know, Lenny Bruce's free speech struggles, prosecuted in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in Illinois, in Chicago at the Gate of Horn, and then in New York, that these things even occurred. And so what we set out to do is to write a biography of Lenny Bruce through the lens of his obscenity trials. It's just an incredible story. When we were done, we found out that contrary to popular belief, the popular belief was that all of Lenny Bruce's convictions had been reversed, either thrown out by judges at the trial level, a jury would find him not guilty, or an appellate court would sustain his First Amendment claims. But when we did the research, we found out, lo and behold, that in New York, where he was convicted of using colorful words in a Greenwich club after dark, that conviction had never been reversed. The reason it had never been reversed is that Lenny had fired his lawyers. He tried to handle his own appeal, and however great a comedian he was, and he was a great comedian, he was an awful lawyer. And so he didn't, for technical reasons, he didn't perfect his appeal, and what that meant was that his conviction was never reversed. He left New York as a criminal, a fugitive, if you will. And then he died on August 3rd, 1966, of an overdose. And that's where the Lenny Bruce story ended, and we put it all together in a book called The Trials of Lenny Bruce. And it occurred to me, you know, just as we were getting toward the end of the book, you know, this precedent stands on the books in New York. And it just seemed like an incredible injustice. So I spoke to David, and the two of us hooked up with Robert Kornrevere, a noted First Amendment lawyer with whom we'd done work, and we petitioned the governor of New York and figured whatever else happened, we thought that this was something that should be done. We never anticipated that it would happen. On the other hand, being committed to the First Amendment, we believe in howling at the moon, as it will, and we were perfectly willing to let it stand there. And then on December 23rd, Governor Pataki did what had never been done. He posthumously pardoned somebody in New York. It's the first time it happened in New York's history. And it's the first time in American history that anybody has been posthumously pardoned for a crime involving free speech. So we were very excited. Mm.
And it is the case, I'm hoping I'm remembering this right, is that at the time that he was charged in this incident in the Cafe Agogo in Greenwich Village, the guy who ran the club was also charged, but his conviction, and he was found guilty as well, but his conviction was later set aside.
After Lenny's death, your point is very well taken, and it was key to our petition. It proves that at the time, our petition was based on the law as it existed in 1964, not as it existed in 2003. So this is kind of no revisionist reworking of history. Our point was that at the time, the law was with Lenny Bruce. By the way, one of your own former governors, Governor Thompson, had argued at the appellate level against Lenny Bruce in an attempt to sustain his conviction. Lenny Bruce had been convicted for a similar act at the Gate of Horn in Chicago, and a trial court had found him guilty and sentenced him to a year, and Governor Thompson was not then governor, but of course he was one of the main lawyers who argued that on appeal, and he argued unsuccessfully to the Illinois Supreme Court that Lenny Bruce's act was not protected under the First Amendment. And it's precisely because of that Illinois ruling that New York courts and others would, in other cases, find the act that Lenny Bruce did permitted under the First Amendment. Hmm.
Lenny Bruce certainly became known for using stand-up to do social commentary. And he talked about things like sex and religion and race that were not generally discussed in public, much less from a platform like that. He, though, when you look at the trajectory of his career, he certainly didn't start out that way. He didn't set out to do that. How is it, do you think, that he ended up going in the direction that he did? And I wonder, you know, to what extent the fact that at various points people said to him, you know, waved the finger in his face and said, look, Mr. Bruce, you can't do that. The fact that people told him he couldn't made him want to do it even more.
My guess is, I'm just here guessing, you know, it's hard, always hard to look into the mind of another human being, let alone a dead one. But my guess is a combination of things. First of all, it was in his DNA. I mean, Lenny Bruce, I mean, his persona was he was the kind of guy that stepped out of line. He's a ranter. He was a troublemaker. He was provocative. It's who he was. So, you know, in time, this sort of thing would come very natural to Lenny Bruce. There might have been some commercial reasons, he thought, you know, to just kind of get attention and what have you. That's certainly within the realm of possibility. But, you know, and he did skyrocket to fame in the late 50s and early 60s, and people like Steve Allen, you know, had him on their show and very much defended him. But after a while, when the police started, you know, coming after him, starting in San Francisco, then in Los Angeles, bust after bust after bust, and, you know, it's not just the words that Lenny used. It's not those four-letter words, those ten-letter words. It was what he was saying about race. It was what he was saying about religion, particularly in Chicago. I mean, that really got, I mean, for all practical purposes, Lenny Bruce was busted in Chicago at the Gate of Horn for blasphemy. And, you know, it was the fact that he was offending people. You know, he was involved in taboo talk, as it were. And more than anything else, that's why he was busted. The words were kind of a legal excuse for prosecutors to come after him. Mm.
These prosecutions were brought in major cities, and I guess if you would think there would be any place where people's attitudes towards this sort of thing would be fairly relaxed, it would be in cities like New York and San Francisco. How, you know, given the fact that some people at least would have made the argument at the time that said this is protected speech, how is it these prosecutions were brought at all?
Well, I would, you know, there was, it's the four cultural centers of freedom, you would have thought, you know, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, New York. I mean, my God, if you can't get freedom there, where else can you possibly get it? Again, I think it is, and this is what the First Amendment is all about, it is the idea that offensive speech, speech that kind of, you know, goes to our core, that offends us about our belief in God and our belief in country and our belief in family and our belief in morals, you know, that affects people in these big cities as much as it does anywhere. And Lenny was an equal opportunity offender. I mean, most of his audience were liberal, but, you know, there were a number of routines he did, and he did one at the Gate of Horn on Adolf Eichmann, which made many Jewish Americans feel uncomfortable. And, you know, other nights he'd be doing something on, the Cardinal or the Pope, which would make many Catholic Americans feel uncomfortable. And one thing about Lenny Bruce's show is when you went to him, and you could hear this. I mean, we have on the CD accompanying the book the actual audio of the routines he did, the nights he did when he was busted, so you can just hear it, you know, in its original form. When you went to a Lenny Bruce show, you never knew what to expect. You never knew who he was going to unleash on that night. And that was part of the excitement of it. On the other hand, you could find yourself laughing one moment and being offended the next and just saying, you know, in that kind of proverbial way, well, now he's crossed the line. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's what Lenny Bruce was all about, crossing lines.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ron Collins. He's a scholar at the First Amendment Center in Arlington, Virginia, and he is the co-author of the book The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon, and it is published by Source Books and looks at both the career of Lenny Bruce and also the various charges against him and the trials that he experienced that had to do with obscenity, or with people who were charging him with using obscenity in his various nightclub performances. There is, as we mentioned, a companion CD that includes some of the material, and if you want to hear it, you're going to have to go out and buy the book because we can't play it. which, and I guess I'm still a little bit confused. I guess part of the reason I'm confused, I guess, is that I know that, for example, were he alive today, Lenny Bruce could do his routines on HBO. And I don't think that there would be any problem. I mean, some people might be offended and angry, but he could do them. My understanding is that I couldn't play it here on this radio show, but on cable, I guess you can pretty much do whatever you want. So to me, I guess I'm still a little bit confused about what it is you can say and where it is you can say it.
Well, the last I heard, the seven dirty words, I mean, in the George Carlin case, the U.S. Supreme Court said could be regulated and that the federal communications could regulate. The last I heard, we'd move from seven dirty words to three. I'm never quite sure which ones you can use and which ones you can't. And even as we speak, the chairman of the Federal Communications Committee, Michael Powell, is trying to decide whether or not the F word, at least in its adjectival form, can be used. And if it could be used, can it be used for political purposes or what have you? But, you know, I mean, it just points out the problem, and that is that, you know, when you set out to censor, it becomes difficult or impossible as to where to draw the line. And that's what Lenny Bruce was all about. He was out there to kind of obliterate those lines, to point out, you know, I mean, there was just so much of his commentary that was political. It didn't appeal to prurient interests. So you say, well, you know, why is it that you, if we listen to Bono or George Carlin or somebody or Margaret Cho, for example, and they use a colorful word, that can't be aired. But why is it if we listen to, you know, the tapes of Richard Nixon or President Johnson with using the same exact words, why is one permissible, you know, in some contexts and not in others? And, you know, this is the whole conundrum. And I believe that if our First Amendment stands for anything, it stands for the proposition that these decisions should not be left to the government. They should be left to individuals and broadcast stations and whatever. Moreover, I think another reason you couldn't play Lenny Bruce, certainly there's some routines he used where there's no colorful language. You might have reservations about playing them because they're not politically correct, even today. I mean, even today. And again, you know, I think one of the big challenges to the First Amendment today is political correctness, and quite often it's liberals who were violating the First Amendment rather than the kind of traditional conservatives, the kind of people we think of who went after Lenny Bruce. By the way, one of Lenny Bruce's early prosecutors, a young guy out of Los Angeles named Johnny Cochran.
Yeah, that's another interesting. It's interesting how people that whose names we now recognize today, perhaps in different sorts of context, were involved in this. One, as you say, was one of our former governors, Jim Thompson, and the other was Johnny Cochran, who at one time was on the other side of the proceedings and was indeed a prosecutor. And
you know, one of the things that was so fascinating about writing this book is, you know, history just causes us all to flip or flop one way or another. I mean, so you had people like Thompson and Cochran who were prosecuting Lenny Bruce, and then a person who really stood, you know, side by side with Lenny Bruce, defended him at when everybody else was, you know, abandoning him, was Steve Allen. And yet, toward the end of his career, Steve Allen led the campaign to kind of clean up the filth, you know, that had come to our airwaves and what have you. So it makes you kind of sometimes wonder, well, you know, what would Steve Allen say about, you know, having Lenny Bruce on the radio today or on television? Hmm.
I wanted to, maybe you could talk specifically about some of these trials, and beginning with the one that took place in San Francisco. This was in 1962, and in which he was acquitted, and the jury apparently afterwards said they weren't happy about that, but they said that based on the instructions they were given by the judge, they felt that they had no choice. So maybe this also gives us an opportunity to talk a little bit about what exactly the law and the court, the big court, has said about this issue of obscenity.
Well, I mean, Lenny, you know, fortune was smiling on his tuchus that day. I mean, God knows, you know, the gods weren't always that kind to him. But basically, you know, the Supreme Court's ruling in 1957, a rather important case, Roth versus United States, and it had been tested in San Francisco when Lawrence Ferlinghetti was busted for selling Howl, the poem by Allen Ginsberg. And one would have thought that, you know, based on that trial when Ferlinghetti was found not guilty by that judge, that that was the end of the matter in San Francisco, that, you know, certain types of expression used for literary purposes or artistic purposes or in clubs. And I think Lenny pretty much assumed that. And so when he was busted in San Francisco, basically busted for, you know, his humor relating to gays and lesbians, of all places, San Francisco. And the judge that he had in that case was the same judge who had exonerated Lawrence Ferlinghetti when Ferlinghetti was prosecuted for selling Howl. And so it's almost as if the decks were stacked. If the jury in San Francisco had been left to their own devices, they would have found Lenny Bruce guilty. But the judge, very sensitive to First Amendment freedoms, gave them instructions that made it all but impossible, if they honored the law, to do anything but find Lenny not guilty. And so they came back grudgingly. They felt that Lenny Bruce was guilty, but true to the First Amendment, at least as presented to them by the judge in San Francisco, they found him not guilty. And so, you know, Lenny Bruce is leaving San Francisco, according to newspaper accounts at the time, and he's all gleeful, and he's, you know, he's off. It's a new day for him, and he's now headed for Chicago, the Windy City, where he thinks, you know, the First Amendment is the wind on his back, and all of his problems are behind him. And little did he know that that was hardly the case.
Yeah. Well, we can talk some more about that, and I do, however, have a caller I want to bring into the conversation and tell anyone, of course, who's listening, if you're interested in joining in, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. That's here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Atlanta, Illinois, and line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I've got a question. If I remember right, I think, didn't Playboy magazine, you know, Chicago connection there, didn't they do a lot to try to bring this Lenny Bruce thing to light and do a lot to try to help that situation as far as Lenny himself?
Absolutely. Hugh Hefner stood with Lenny Bruce for any variety of on any variety of occasions in instances which would really not in any way bring him any financial gain, him meaning Hefner. He also hooked up Lenny Bruce with Maurice Rosenfield, a very prominent lawyer who's still, I'm pleased to say, still alive and with us today, and played a very important role in when we wrote The Trials of Lenny Bruce. Had hooked up Lenny Bruce with Maury Rosenfield, who would successfully, along with Harry Calvin from the University of Chicago, and William Ming represent Lenny in the Illinois Supreme Court. So yes, Hefner at the time did play a significant role. There were a handful of people that stood by Lenny Bruce when he was in dire straits. Hugh Hefner was one of those people. Steve Allen was another. And Phil Spector, who now has his own problems with the law, was yet another.
Well, it's an interesting conversation, and I remember reading the Playboy articles years ago, and it seemed to me like, you know, reading those articles years ago, there was always a vendetta. Wherever Lenny went, there was always some kind of vendetta against him. People were looking to pick on him, so I appreciate your book. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, caller.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we talked just a moment ago about the San Francisco trial and the fact that Lenny Bruce was fortunate that the judge had strong feelings about the First Amendment, and based on his instructions to the jury found him not guilty. Otherwise, they probably would have. So then now he goes on to Chicago, and he is arrested once again for this performance at this place called the Gate of Horn. Here the result, the outcome, though, was different. In that trial, he was found guilty. What was the difference between the two?
Who could have ever imagined? I mean, for one thing, I don't think it would ever occur to Lenny Bruce that, you know, he'd be busted in Chicago. I mean, Chicago was too hip. I mean, you know, and particularly at the Gate of Horn. Your caller, last caller, had it right. There was a vendetta in many respects against Bruce, in many towns. And he comes into Chicago, and as freewheeling as the city was in those days, it did have its Irish Catholic devout segment, and I don't say that in any critical way. And so when Lenny Bruce comes to town and, you know, goes after the Pope and the Cardinal and the Bishop with wild abandon and does so in a colorful way, it catches the attention of local authorities. And it, believe me, it caught them. It definitely caught the attention. And so he's at the Gate of Horn. He's performing. And the police come in, and they basically say that he's being arrested for blasphemy. He's not being formally charged with that. And they tell the owner of the Gate of Horn that if this continues, they're going to shut the club down. This meaning these attacks on the Catholic Church. And the Gate of Horn in time does close down because of the Lenny Bruce prosecution. And you know what happened from thereafter was so bizarre. It was almost something right out of a Lenny Bruce skit. And when we wrote this book, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, one of the things that was so exciting about it was this kind of these bizarre situations that always seem to find Lenny Bruce. Here he is. He comes into he's basically charged with blasphemy. He's formally charged with obscenity, of course, and he comes into court with his lawyer, who's Jewish and from New York. So they're the only two Jewish guys there in the room. And they look around, and everybody, you know, the judge, the jury, the foreman, the bailiff, the lawyers, everybody has ashes on their forehead. It's Ash Wednesday. And here he is, you know, being prosecuted, in effect, for, you know, dissing the Catholic hierarchy. I mean, it was just bizarre. And when it was done, Judge Ryan... the jury finds Lenny guilty, and Judge Ryan sentenced Lenny Bruce to 1 year in jail for word crimes in a club after dark in Chicago. And by the way, on appeal, Lenny Bruce has about the best three lawyers ever. He has Harry Calvin, a noted First Amendment scholar, now deceased, from the University of Chicago. He has Maury Rosenfield, very prominent lawyer, very skilled in civil liberties and other areas. And he has William Ming, a guy who's been kind of lost to history. Ming, prominent civil rights lawyer, had worked with Thurgood Marshall on Brown v. Board, and would have probably been on the Supreme Court had he not had some run-in with the law about tax returns, for which he went to jail years later. But these are his three attorneys, and a case goes to the Illinois Supreme Court. Lenny loses in the Illinois Supreme Court, and then about a month or so later, this decision comes down from the U.S. Supreme Court involving the First Amendment, And the Illinois Supreme Court asks the parties in the case to rebrief the case, and the Illinois Supreme Court tells the parties that it, on its own motion, is now going to reconsider its ruling. And in what has to be a first, the Illinois Supreme Court reverses itself and upholds Lenny Bruce's rights to perform on First Amendment grounds. It was an incredible moment in legal history, and it happened there in the state of Illinois.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ron Collins. He is an attorney. He's also a scholar at the First Amendment Center in Arlington, Virginia, and he is the co-author of a book that we've been talking about here. The book is titled The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon, which looks at his various trials for obscenity. The book is published by Source Books, so you can head out to the bookstore and take a look at it if you're interested. Also, questions, comments here are welcome on the show, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're now headed into our second half, and again, we'd just like to remind callers to be brief, please, because that helps us keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. Here next, we have someone listening in Champaign. We'll go to line one. Hello.
Hi. I hope I haven't missed any discussion of this so far, but could your guest actually talk about First Amendment issues today and how he sees this book in relation to them, or maybe there's no relation, but actually maybe talk about the Patriot II Act and things of that nature?
Well, I would be glad to address that question. The Patriot Act obviously raises a number of issues, but they're a little wider the mark, at least in terms of what we spoke about in the trials of Lenny Bruce. If you just start with the basic proposition that what Lenny Bruce was prosecuted for, first and foremost, was offensive ideas, that whole notion of offensive ideas continues to plague us today. It may be people marching in Skokie. It may be people who are involved in expression that's not politically correct. It may be so-called indecent words on our airwaves and whether or not someone can or can't use them. So it may be artists putting on shows at public museums that some people find obscene or indecent or offensive in some way. So that whole principle, I mean, you know, going after a person for offensive ideas, that's as much a part of our culture today as it was then. You know, somebody might find themselves on TV saying something about the war, or might find some saying something colorful about gays or lesbians or civil rights or whatever the issue may be. And so one of the reasons that David Scover and I petitioned the governor of Pataki of New York to posthumously pardon Lenny Bruce, and now that pardon has been granted, is to, you know, have some formal recognition of the importance of the First Amendment, to kind of make New York a safe haven for free speech, for speech that, you know, we tolerate even though it offends us. And, you know, Lenny Bruce's audience, quite often, they had no problem when he was going after Catholics. But, you know, then when he started, you know, doing routines about Jews, that might make them feel uncomfortable, or vice versa, you know. And one of the things was, as I said, he was an equal opportunity offender. And so, if anything, the story of Lenny Bruce is the story, in many ways, of free speech in America. It's the whole story about, you know, how we as the people do or do not deal with speech that offends us. And I think, if anything, what was for us as people very interested in working with the First Amendment, we were so excited when we wrote The Trials of Lenny Bruce, was that this principle comes out yet again. And in that respect, whether or not Lenny Bruce's routines would or wouldn't be permitted in a comedy club today has to be considered against the larger point. By the way, Lenny Bruce almost single-handedly liberated comedy clubs. I mean, after Lenny Bruce was prosecuted and died, there was never again a prosecution in a comedy club for word crimes, just words alone. And, you know, I think our clubs are better for it, better that people can go and speak in an uninhibited, robust, wide-open way without looking over their back as to whether or not the police are going to come after them. I think they're better that we have talent like Margaret Cho and George Carlin, who can, or Robin Williams going on HBO, and can speak freely without fear of being hauled off to jail. That legacy is due in significant measure to what Lenny Bruce did and the trials he endured in the 60s.
It seems like you're talking about, you know, saying what can't be said or saying what can't be thought, or thought control or cultural mm-hmm. control. But how do you, I have an idea, but how do you connect that to political correctness? And is there any way of encouraging respect for difference without shutting down free speech?
Well, caller, you're raising all the right questions. You know, when you say political correctness, obviously we should all have sensitivities when it comes to matters of race, when it comes to matter of gender, when it comes to, you know, sexual orientation, whatever. Any decent society that respects people and respects humankind would do that. But when the government comes in and says, well, you know, Lenny Bruce, you cannot do that routine on Adolf Eichmann because it would offend Jews. Or, Lenny Bruce, you cannot do this routine on gays and lesbians because it would offend gays and lesbians. Or, Lenny Bruce, you cannot do this routine on Catholics because it would offend them. This is where political correctness, you know, butts its head, or rams, if you will, the First Amendment. And I suspect that, you know, much of Lenny Bruce's routines, if performed on college campuses today, the people who would be trying to shut that expression down, my guess is, quite often, though not always, would be liberals.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
We have certainly time for other folks if you want to call in and ask a question, make a comment. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the New York trial, which was probably the biggest of all. This actually took place before the Illinois Supreme Court set aside Bruce's conviction in the Gate of
right.
Horn trial. This was the one based on the routine he did at the Cafe Agogo, and this was the conviction that for which Pataki just issued the pardon. This was an amazing case, at least if you look at how long it took, how many people were involved. Although the participants only spent 13 actual days in court, this thing stretched over 6 months, and there were more than 1,600 pages of court transcript. This was when you look at the time and energy and how many people were involved, this was an amazing undertaking, particularly when you consider the fact that we only were talking about a misdemeanor here and not exactly a high crime.
Well, you're absolutely right, and thank you for having read the book. I really appreciate that. It doesn't always happen on talk radio. Yeah, it was just, you know, when we were writing this book, we couldn't believe it. I mean, the more research we did, and, you know, just to find all these things out. But before I spend a moment on the New York trial, just let me quickly mention something about the Los Angeles trial. It had its moments, as all of them did.
Oh, sure.
In Los Angeles, Lenny was using colorful words in Yiddish. And, of course, in order to, you know, get a conviction under the obscenity laws, people have to understand that something's offensive. And so, you know, the prosecutors in L.A. found themselves a Jewish sheriff who understood Yiddish, who went to the show and took notes, and thereafter, you know, came after Lenny Bruce for using obscene words in a foreign tongue, to wit, Yiddish. Again, it could have made for a wonderful Lenny Bruce shtick, but in Los Angeles they cannot obtain a conviction, and then we move on to New York. Yes, you're right. Lenny Bruce performs at the Cafe Agogo in New York in April of 1964. You know, and he's busted not once but twice, along with the owner of the club and Richard Q, the man who prosecuted the case, and others made it pretty clear that they were going to go, you know, to the mat on this. As you mentioned, the case lasted, you know, on and off for 6 months. It was before three trial judges. Again, it was a misdemeanor. You know, scores and scores of witnesses testified, including Nat Hintoff, the syndicated columnist, who I'm happy to say agreed to narrate the CD that accompanies our book. And it was the trial of the absurd. It was bizarre. You know, you just couldn't imagine that this was happening in America in the 60s, no less, in the whole explosion of the counterculture. And here Lenny Bruce is being prosecuted. And when the prosecution, when the arrest first starts out, a number of celebrities, you know, make a public statement and sign a petition protesting it. And those celebrities included, Woody Allen, Bob Dylan, Elizabeth Taylor, and just a whole host of others. And, you know, they were incensed by this, and yet the prosecution went on. Toward the end of the trial, Lenny Bruce, in his wisdom, and I say that in a satirical way, he fires his lawyers, Ephraim London, the lead attorney, and then Martin Garvis, the associate counsel. He fires them for no apparent reason, and he decides that he's going to handle the end of his trial himself. And toward the end of his trial, you know, with just about a week to go, he approaches the bench, and he serves each of the three judges who, within a week, will pass on, you know, his judgment. He serves each of them with a complaint. He is suing them for violating his First Amendment rights. I mean, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be comic. It is an example of an American standing on his rights, looking the law in the eye, literally, and saying, "I will not back down." We might applaud him as being a courageous defender of the First Amendment. Of course, it didn't bode well for the fate that would soon befall him, and by a 2-1 decision, this trial court finds Lenny Bruce guilty and sentences him to 4 months in Rikers. Mm. And he fails to, he's going to handle his appeal, and he fails to perfect it, and he skips town. He's a fugitive. What's amazing is that New York never attempted to extradite him for this misdemeanor. And by that time, he's out of luck. He's out of money. Prozac hasn't been invented. He's depressed. He's got a monkey on his back. He's, as Bob Dylan put it, a junkyard angel. Dylan, by the way, did a song called Lenny. And on August 3rd, 1966, Lenny Bruce dies of an overdose. Penniless, nobody really to defend him. Phil Spector picks up the tab for his funeral. And then within a year or two afterwards, he rises from the ashes like this phoenix. And all of a sudden, America embraces the comedian that they had prosecuted in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York. He becomes this great cultural icon, and biographies are written about him. The Essential Lenny Bruce comes out. Broadway play by Julian Barry called Lenny. And then the movie with Dustin Hoffman, Lenny, and all of a sudden, Lenny Bruce becomes this great American icon. And when we wrote The Trials of Lenny Bruce, he'd already had this status as a great American icon. What we tried to do was to say, you know, he really deserves a status as a great American icon as a defender of free speech. Yeah. And that's what The Trials of Lenny Bruce was all about.
Well, that's, you know, point to one of the great ironies here. Is as you write it in the book, I don't know who penned the line, but it's a good line. The best years of Lenny Bruce's life came after his death. And that is true. A little bit later, how could a comic vilified by the state and abandoned by so many be resurrected as a free speech hero? But in fact, that is exactly what happened.
You know, I was being flip when I said I penned that line. David Skoer and I wrote every line in the book together, more or less. But, you know, it is, if you think about what you just mentioned, you know, it's kind of sick how we treat our heroes, you know. We admire them and we praise them when they're dead, you know. I mean, it's when they're living, you know, we're making their lives miserable. And if anything else, I hope that this book serves as a lesson of the importance not to have any more First Amendment martyrs, you know. If Lenny Bruce were alive today, I have no doubt that he would be saying things that would be offending people right and left, and that, you know, people in every locale would be trying to find ways to censor him, to shut him up, to shut him down, to run him out of town. And, that's, again, what I think is why this story, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, is such a fascinating story in American history and in the history of the First Amendment in this country.
Well, certainly more than one person has commented on Bruce's self-destructive personality. At the same time, you have to acknowledge what going through these various prosecutions did. He, as you say, that he ended up broke. Nobody wanted to nobody wanted to employ him. Nobody wanted to hire him for their club because they were afraid of what he would say, and that not only would he be prosecuted, they would be prosecuted. He really became something of a persona non grata. So I guess you have to wonder to what extent his legal troubles contributed to the way that his life ended, or, you know, whether he was maybe headed that way anyway.
Yeah, you know, he, like Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and others, I mean, he was on the fast track. You could see it coming. I mean, when he died, Phil Spector said in a rather flip way, he died of an overdose of cops. Is there some truth to that? Yeah, but, you know, he had his own problems. He had his own devils, his own demons. Certainly drugs, hard drugs, were one of them. And, you know, the depression, the fact that he was out of money, you know, all of those things. In fact, as I said, one of his Illinois lawyers, Maury Rosenfield, did everything he could to prevent Lenny from self-destructing, you know, and he was, I mean, here was Lenny trying to argue his case on appeal. Maury Rosenfield knew this was going to be disastrous, and he was doing everything in his power to kind of convince Bruce to let, you know, some seasoned lawyers handle this case and telling him that if you only listen to us, you'll win. Of course, Lenny didn't followed the wisdom that Maury Rosenfield gave to him, and it cost him. So, yeah, there was this self-destructive side. But, you know, Bob Dylan has that great line, you know, if you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. And it really was a lot about Lenny Bruce. I mean, he'd be in those nightclubs, and the blue would be lined up in the back, you know, 5-8 strong. You know, there, taking down notes, if you can believe it. And it didn't stop him at all. He just went on and did it, and then, you know, he'd be hauled away in handcuffs. It takes a lot to do that. Some would call it courageous. Some would call it self-destructive. Probably a little bit of both.
Our guest, Ron Collins, he's the co-author of the book, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon. And we have about 10 minutes left. We have several callers. We'll try to get everybody in, starting with Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Is there a point where a society has a right to protect its decency?
Is there a point, caller, at which, I'm sorry?
At which society has a right to protect its decency?
Yes, society protects its decency in any variety of ways. Whether or not it needs to do that in order to censor expression is yet another call. I mean, there's all sorts of ways we as parents, we as educators, we as people of faith exercise that right as well we should. I have an 11-year-old. I do it every day.
Well, now, you cited Steve Allen. Steve Allen was certainly no bigot, but he was disgusted by the depths to which some of the public entertainment had sunk. And I think he used the, he said that it had sunk to the place where vulgarians were entertaining barbarians. Do you remember that?
Not only it's mentioned in the trials of Lenny Bruce, your caller, you're right on the money. And one of the questions, we had planned to interview Steve Allen, and, you know, it's awful, but he died, so there's nothing we could have done. But one of the questions we would ask him is, how is it that you, Steve Allen, who defended Lenny Bruce until the day Steve Allen died and never once deviated from that course, defended Lenny Bruce's First Amendment right? And I think the answer was that he thought that the government had no business enforcing laws in this way, but that if commercial entities, broadcasters and others decided that they didn't want this quote-unquote filth, that was their judgment and the government had to leave it alone.
Well, now, there are many universities, I think they still have speech codes, don't they?
I think a number of those speech codes probably violate the First Amendment.
Yeah, and I don't know that they do. I'm certainly against them, but the N-word is certainly not permitted on the public airways and shouldn't be. Do you believe people should use that N-word on the public
airways? Well, Randall Kennedy wrote a book called Nigger, and he's a Harvard professor, and he talked about how that book is, how that word is used in our music, how it's used in songs. I mean, you know, do I approve of it being used in a pejorative way as a racial epithet? No, I don't. But the fact is, and if you read Randall Kennedy's book called Nigger, an African-American law professor at Harvard University, you will see what happens when the government attempts to censor even a word with all of that kind of racist baggage.
Yeah, but we can discuss race, and we can discuss every part of race, without using that word? Can't we, without being pejorative, without degrading anyone? Can't we do that?
Well, I just used it.
Yeah, well, I know, but you used it in a very generic way.
Well, Lenny Bruce had a routine, and it opened with, "Are there any niggers here tonight?" He had a routine, and that was and the whole purpose of that. And thereafter, he went and mentioned a number of other groups, was to defang the word of its racist impact. That was his whole idea. And it's not as if words come from the Almighty, you know, filled with all this. And so the whole idea of when Lenny Bruce did that routine was to withdraw from it, was to devalue, if you will, its racist impact. Whether or not that is or is not a good idea, I'll leave to you to decide, but it is not a question that the government should decide.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. Again, we're really getting short on time, and I'd like to try to get in some others. Next caller is in southeastern Illinois on our line one. Hello.
Yeah, I can perfectly understand Steve Allen's stance in defending the right to free speech and being unhappy about the result. I mean, it's sort of a Gresham's theory of coinage working in language. One question that I was wondering is the U.S. Supreme Court decision that affected the Illinois Supreme Court decision. What did that involve? Was that a book or something?
And that was Jack Bellis versus Ohio. That was argued by Ephraim London, who was Lenny Bruce's New York lawyer. And in the Jack Bellis case, which had a variety of opinions, the court made it clear, primarily speaking to the question of literary context, that the standard for obscenity was far more liberal than the Illinois Supreme Court had thought it to be.
Well, Douglas was just
yes.
Douglas was. I mean, there were a whole series of books that were had been banned at.
You're absolutely right, caller.
Yeah. I'll move on and let someone else talk.
Thank you, sir.
Let's go to Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hello. This is, I think it's something I heard on NPR that, and it's not the legal, well, it has legal implications, but he was denied a performance license, right? And that, I mean, obviously he was barred from playing in New York after the...
Yeah, he was also denied performance licenses and even access to England.
It's kind of hard for us to imagine that you need a performance license. I guess you could say that it could come from, like, some cultural outfit, but I think it was actually handled by the police department.
You're absolutely right. It was that's what you needed in those days. It was almost kind of like this board of censors, and it just shows you... how, at least in the lifetime of some of us, how different the world was.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to, I think, highlight that, because...
And once they yanked that from you, you were dead. You couldn't perform anywhere, and that was Lenny Bruce's problem.
Caller, do you have something further? Well, I guess maybe he's not there anymore. And in any case, here we have to maybe about 3-4 minutes just to get to the bottom line on free speech as far as you're concerned. I was thinking about the conversation you had a couple of callers back. Is it your position that basically on speech that we don't like, as you would say, if you don't like it, don't listen? I mean, is that it?
Well, not only that, I won't say this. I believe in participatory democracy. I believe that if there are racists carrying racist messages in the street, people of good conscience have to go out there and confront that. You know, I think Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, had it right. You know, the answer is not censorship, it's more speech. And we exercise our First Amendment rights when we stand up to bigots, when we stand up to people with sexist attitudes, when we stand up to people who are homophobic, when we stand up to people who agree or disagree with our position on Iraq. I mean, and that's what this, you know, this experiment in freedom is all about. And so I don't fear speech. I think we're the better and the stronger at the end of the day when we speak our minds and speak freely.
And for those people who are concerned about the coarsening of the culture, who might say something like that in fact Lenny Bruce and what he did started us on the proverbial slippery slope to where we are today, where maybe a lot of people would, even if they, as I say, even if they do believe strongly in the First Amendment, would say, but on the other hand, I'm not real happy about the way that it's exercised.
Well, you know, you make a good point. You know, with liberty comes success, excess. There's no doubt about it. I mean, Lenny helped to coarsen the culture a bit. But when I go and watch Margaret Cho, and when I listen to her, and I laugh, and I listen to her talk about sex and racism and what have you, and it makes me think, and even when she's using colorful language that some would find coarse, I think we're the better for it. But, you know, as I said, you know, with liberty comes a certain amount of excess, and if we don't like these things, we, the people, have to stand up for our moral values. And if it means Christians having Bible groups, being able to have Bible groups and have them in public schools and elsewhere and going to the public forum, more power to them. The First Amendment has no favorites. And, you know, if we're concerned about the coarsening of our culture, then let people of conscience, Jewish, Muslim, Catholic, Christian, Protestant, whatever their background, let them go out into the community, let them preach their gospel, and if it makes our country better, we're all the better.
Well, there is a good point for us to stop. Our guest this morning is Ron Collins. He is a scholar at the First Amendment Center in Arlington, Virginia, and he is the co-author, along with David Scover, who teaches law as well at Seattle University. They are the co-authors of the book, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon, and Source Books is the publisher. And Mr. Collins, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for sharing your airwaves with me.
All right.